If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Crime and Crime Again is a true crime podcast containing subject matter that may be graphic or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. In 1974, Richard Nixon was the president of the United States until he resigned and Gerald Ford was sworn into office. Barbra Streisand's The Way We Were was dominating the charts and would later be named Billboard's number one song that year. Eggs were only about 58 cents per dozen. And that year, 20-year-old Catherine O'Connell, known to family and friends as Kit, landed a job working at the It's a Small World attraction at Disneyland in Anaheim, California. It was there that Kit met the foreman of the It's a Small World attraction, a man named Gregory Mordick. Gregory had a college degree, had served in Vietnam, and much like Kit, he loved food and cooking. The pair hit it off quickly, and in 1977, they got married, and so Catherine O'Connell became Catherine Mordick. The newlyweds moved into a home on South Ridgecrest Circle in Anaheim Hills, California, and in 1978, they welcomed their first child, a baby girl named Elise. In 1980, their second daughter, Brianna, was born. After venturing into marriage and then motherhood, Kit was ready for another new adventure. She had studied home economics and discovered that she had a passion and a knack for food styling. You know the commercials from restaurants that convince you that you need that cheeseburger or that shrimp scampi immediately? That was Kit's job. As it turned out, her husband Greg was a bit of an amateur photographer. So the couple decided that eventually they would open up their own studio and work together. Kit would set up and style the food, and Greg would be the photographer. In the meantime, Kit began working with another photographer, and some of her work was even published in the LA Times Home magazine in the early 80s. Greg spent much of their marriage at home with the girls, finding few opportunities to pursue his photography. Kit was the primary breadwinner, and it actually seemed that Greg had a difficult time maintaining jobs. In February 1981, Kit began working with a photographer named Henry Bjoin, and within a few months, their relationship escalated to more than colleagues. Kit and Henry were having an affair. But consumed with guilt, Kit ended up confessing her affair to her husband, Greg. Greg was a devout journal keeper. It should be noted that the contents of Greg's journals were unknown until several years after the events of this case. But I thought it would be easier to follow the timeline if I went ahead and included Greg's journal entries in chronological order within the context of the story. On August 31st, 1981, Greg Mordick wrote in his journal, quote, "Kit had an affair with Henry. The act has not diminished my love or devotion to her one bit. I'm truly in love with a special person. I find myself surprisingly acceptable to this whole situation. Now let's get on with our love and life and anyone who will join us, as long as the joiner does not try and hurt what Kit and I have," end quote. It seemed that Kit had ended the affair, and that she and Greg were willing to move forward together and work on their marriage. But according to an entry in Greg's journal, Henry was not ready to accept that his affair with Kit was over. By September 27th, 1981, Greg had been fired from his job. In his journal, he wrote, quote, "This situation with Kit and Henry is wearing me down. He just refuses to accept the fact that Kit does not want to leave me for him. He is constantly laying the guilt trip on her and playing her emotions against her. She has told Henry it is over, that she wants to devote all of her energies to the family, but Henry is a little dense. He keeps hanging in there hoping I will throw in the towel and walk away. No way. I love what I have with Kit and I am not about to give her up. And especially not my girls," end quote. Over the course of the next year, Greg wrote several more journal entries that detailed his marital struggles with Kit. As it turned out, Kit never quite committed to ending her affair with Henry. By June 1982, Greg's journal entries told of Kit's apparent desire to rekindle the flame between her and Henry. It's unknown whether or not Kit and Henry were still secretly seeing one another at this point. But according to later court documents, Kit and Henry ended their affair in late August 1981 and did not resume their affair until the summer of 1982. In August 1982, Kit and Greg's marriage seemed to finally reach a point of no return. On August 12, 1982, Greg wrote in his journal, quote, "Kit read my diary last night. She decided she wanted to know what was going on. She read the list of girls I had been to bed with, and the ones I fooled around with, and the ones I was tempted with. I probably should have been honest with her before. But what can I do now? The damage is done. Her trust has been shattered. She will be open only to what she wants to. In a sense, I am relieved. It has been a heavy burden on my heart, knowing I had done a few things that I was not honest about. I wonder if it will make Kit want to see Henry. I don't blame her if she does. She feels betrayed by me, and rightly so. I can in no way justify what I have done, nor can I explain why I have behaved so." End quote. And by September, it appeared that Kit had discovered the full extent of Greg's deception. On September 8, 1982, he wrote, quote, "A little flashback. August 22nd, 1 a.m., Kit and I had one of our usual arguments and I left for Kansas. I wanted to see my grandparents. They are old now and not well. Then I came home, but should have stayed away longer. Kit and I are no better off. Her distance to me is farther. I don't blame her. All of my deceptions have come to light. No service in Vietnam, did not graduate from college, and a few more to cover an escape route from this relationship." End quote. For 8 years, five of those married, Kit had been led to believe that the man she fell in love with was a college graduate and a Vietnam veteran, not to mention the other unspecified lies about his identity. Kit also found another curious entry in Greg's journals, a list of women's names: Nancy, Dixie, two Kathys, Debbie, two Cindys, Johanna, Bonnie. Some of the names were starred, some circled. When Kit confronted Greg about this list, he claimed that he was not having any affairs. It was simply a list of women that he admired. As we just heard from Greg's journal entries, that was obviously a lie. He wrote in his journal that those were the names of women he had slept with. But what's not clear about that journal entry is whether he had slept with those women during his marriage to Kit, or if those were women he had slept with in the past. For years, Greg had lied to Kit about who he was, and this discovery put the final nail in the coffin in which their marriage would be laid to rest. Other journal entries in September 1982 told of Greg's fears concerning their marriage and his relationship with his daughters. On September 13, 1982, he wrote, quote, "The thought of not making things work and me separated from my little ones just drives me crazy. I want and need them every day, not just once in a while, not just for a couple of hours." End quote. And on September 24th, quote, "The hardest part is saying goodbye to my girls, not tucking them in. For once, my tangled web will cause me pain that I don't know if I can bear. This will be devastating. This is almost incapacitating." End quote. It seems that at that point, to some degree, Greg had moved out of the house, or was at the very least no longer staying there overnight. Sometime in October 1982, Kit's sister Donna allegedly witnessed an incident of domestic violence between Kit and Greg. According to Donna, while Kit, Greg, and their daughters were over at her house helping her and her husband move, there was one point at which Elise, Kit's oldest daughter, ran outside to her Aunt Donna and shouted, "Mommy needs help." Donna said that she ran into the home and saw that Greg had Kit by the shoulders and was shaking her. It should be noted that Donna's husband at the time would later testify at trial that Kit did not help them move in October 1982. Whether that means that that incident didn't happen at that time, or that the incident didn't happen at all, is unclear. By October 20th, 1982, it was official. In his journal that day, Greg wrote, quote, "Kitty and I are finally separated. I moved all my things out. It is really hard to take. It is very inconvenient living here with my parents in Poway. I am too far from my little ones. I am too far from Kitty, whom I love very much." End quote. The implications of their separation and their impending divorce weighed heavily on Greg's mind and heart. specifically custody arrangements. On November 29th, 1982, he wrote, quote, "I wish I could get custody, but the courts seem to favor mothers. Fathers lose all around for some reason. The love I have for my girls should carry me through life. I just pray Kitty does not move too far away. That would really break my heart," end quote. After the separation, tensions between Kit and Greg did not settle. They seemed to only worsen. Sometime in December 1982, while Kit and her sister Donna were at their parents' house, Greg arrived to return the girls to Kit. At some point during the short time he was at the house, Donna allegedly heard screaming, and she soon found Kit cowering in a corner with Greg towering over her. According to Donna, Greg was on top of Kit, quote-unquote, striking her, hitting her, pounding her. Their two daughters were apparently watching when this was occurring, and Kit urged Donna to quickly get the girls out of the room. On December 12, 1982, Greg wrote in his journal, quote, "Goodbye, Kitty. Kitty and I had a fight this evening. She struck me, I lost my temper and struck back. The girls were watching. Oh, the hurt to have such tender eyes see the anger in their parents. To see the anger in Kitty for me, growing even as we are apart. Time has not healed anything for her, only festered bad feelings for me," end quote. And on December 19th, after he returned the girls home to Kit 25 minutes late, he wrote that Kit told him, quote, "After the first of the year, she will no longer be so generous and some real changes were going to be made. I'm afraid she will start using the kids to strike back at me. They are going to be greatly hurt by her anger and dislike for me. I would greatly like custody of Elise and Brianna, but the courts don't smile on daddies too often. Even good daddies, but not so good husbands," end quote. Between December 1982 and early January 1983, Kit met with family law attorney Bernard Leckie, seeking counsel on her impending divorce. On January 4th, 1983, Leckie filed a petition for the dissolution of Kit's marriage to Greg. On January 11th, Kit and Greg met with Leckie to discuss the proceedings and other arrangements pertaining to the divorce, and it was then that Greg learned that he would be paying a minimum of $650 a month in child support for the next 16 years. Leckie would later claim that during this meeting, Greg was quiet and, quote-unquote, almost sullen, but was also quite agreeable and did not contest any of the terms of the divorce. It does not appear that Greg ever retained an attorney of his own for the divorce proceedings. Divorce proceedings were scheduled for January 28, 1983. On January 12, 1983, the day after the meeting with Kit and her attorney, Greg wrote in his journal, quote, "I need a lot of money to pay for Kit's and my separation. I have another 16 years of paying child support. A lot of money starting at $650 a month," end quote. And on January 18th, he wrote, quote, "It is such a letdown after the girls are gone. The sunshine and laughter is gone. An empty hurt in my stomach replaces the smiles and feeling ultimate joy. Such peaks and valleys. I pray my heart will remain strong. At times, I get so weak and just want to go away somewhere to relieve confusion for the girls. I know I will always have their love. I have given it to them so freely. Then I won't hear Brianna say how hard it is having two different parents. I know I could ease their pain by going away. I know Kitty would not mind," end quote. By this time in January 1983, Kit was planning to move from Anaheim up to Los Angeles, about 45 minutes away. She had already started packing to prepare to move in early February. Kit and Greg's usual custody arrangement allowed Greg to have the girls every other weekend. They ended up switching the arrangement around for the weekend of January 21st through 23rd so that Greg would have the girls that weekend. Kit agreed to this so that the girls would be with her on the weekend that she moved out of her house in Anaheim. Not only was she preparing to move, but Kit was also scheduled to appear in court with Greg for their divorce proceedings on January 28, 1983. On Friday, January 21st, 1983, Kit took her two daughters up to Los Angeles with her to go house hunting. They also visited Henry's studio while in the city, and they reportedly left the studio to return home to Anaheim around 2 p.m. that day. Greg was scheduled to pick up the girls that evening. For some reason, Greg did not pick up the girls that evening. He would instead end up picking them up the next morning. Kit had plans with her brother Joe for Saturday, January 22nd. But Kit never showed up to Joe's house, and she never called him or his wife to let them know what was going on. Believing that she was likely just busy packing up for her move, Joe didn't think much of it. But on the evening of Sunday, January 23rd, an unexpected visitor turned up at Joe's house. It was Henry, Kit's boyfriend. He was concerned and told Joe that he hadn't heard from Kit and couldn't get in contact with her. So Joe and Henry decided to drive to Kit's house to see what was going on.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When they arrived at Kit's house on South Ridgecrest Circle in Anaheim around 10:30 p.m. on January 23rd, they saw that there were no lights on inside. There was no response to the doorbell or their knocks on the door. It looked as though Kit wasn't home. They had decided to leave and wait for Kit to call them, but as they made their way back to the car, Henry took a peek into the garage. Kit's car was there. This raised the alarm for both men, and Kit's brother Joe wrapped a shirt around his arm, preparing to bust a window open to get into the house. But Henry had run around to the back door of the home, and before Joe could send his fist flying through a window, he heard Henry scream. Moments later, Henry opened the front door to let Joe inside. And there she was. 28-year-old Catherine Kit Mordick lay deceased on the floor of her dining room. Her throat had been slit to the point that she was nearly decapitated. Kit's black skirt was pulled up over her waist, and she had no underwear on. Her underwear and a pair of tights she had been wearing were on the floor next to her. According to Joe, Henry was inconsolable upon discovering Kit's body. They called the police, and Henry sat down at the kitchen table, next to Kit's body, while they awaited law enforcement's arrival. Police received the call at 10:50 p.m., and they were at the scene on South Ridgecrest Circle by 11 p.m. They immediately began questioning Joe and Henry and surveying the scene before them. The only signs of a struggle were a tall, potted plant that had been knocked over, as well as a television and a set of stereo speakers that had been placed on the floor in the living room near the front door of the home. The house, in general, was rather messy and disorganized, though that could be because Kit was preparing for a big move. On the dining room table, next to Kit's body, lay a curious piece of evidence. An envelope, addressed to Kit's soon-to-be ex-husband, Gregory Mordick. Inside of the envelope was a letter, written by Kit. Part of the letter said, quote, "I want to say these things to you because I want to go forward. I've had enough of this hanging in limbo, feeling awful. I'm ready to go forward. I don't want to be disgruntled or angry. I want you to know I forgive you for everything, and ask your forgiveness for the very deep pain I put you through," end quote. Remember that Kit and Greg's upcoming divorce proceedings were scheduled for January 28, 1983. Kit was murdered 6 days before that court date. Blood was found in various locations throughout the scene. On Kit's body, on the carpet beneath the dining room table near where Kit lay, along the chairs at the dining room table, the underside of the dining room table, in the downstairs bathroom sink, on the television near the front door, on the drapery of the rear sliding door, and on the rear sliding door itself. A pair of underwear and a pair of tights were found near Kit's body. No blood was found on either garment. One of Greg's fingerprints was lifted from the bottom of the television. But again, Greg lived in the house for 4 years prior to moving out. It's unclear whether any other fingerprints were lifted from the scene and identified. Deputy Coroner Joseph Lucky arrived on the scene at 2:55 a.m. on January 24th. He made a preliminary estimate at the scene that Kit's death most likely occurred quote-unquote, in the PM hours of January 22nd. The autopsy was performed at 10 a.m. on January 24th by Dr. Richard Fukumoto, and it provided a more detailed picture of what Kit had suffered on the night of her murder. Dr. Fukumoto found that Kit had sustained multiple bruises during the attack, one on her right temple, one above her right ear, and an abrasion on the right side of her chin. These injuries were most likely caused by a round object, such as a baseball bat or a fist. According to Dr. Fukumoto's report, he stated that he observed, quote, two gaping cuts in the neck area, extending from below the left jaw, angle of the jaw towards the midline, and in a somewhat downward angle, end quote. One of the cuts was 7 inches long, the other 3 inches long. Dr. Fukumoto noted that the cuts were very deep. The cervical bone in the back of Kit's neck was cut by the knife. There were 4 hesitation marks on Kit's neck, indicating that her attacker briefly stopped stabbing her 4 different times. Whether this was because Kit was moving and fighting back, or for some other reason, is unknown. Both her jugular vein and carotid artery were severed in the attack. This would have caused substantial bleeding. Kit bled out in mere minutes. Swabs taken from Kit's genital and vaginal areas were negative for any male DNA. Blood samples taken from both Kit's body and the crime scene were tested to determine the blood type of the contributor. This was the only method of testing available for blood samples at the time. Extracting DNA profiles from the blood was not yet a possibility in 1983. During the autopsy, Dr. Fukumoto determined that Kit had likely died between 36 and 48 hours before he performed the autopsy, which again was at 10 a.m. on January 24th, 1983. That would put the estimated time of death between 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. on January 22nd. Just after 3 a.m., 4 hours after Kit's body had been discovered, Detective John Cross with the Anaheim Police Department called Greg Mordick to deliver the news. Greg immediately told Detective Cross that he had been at Kit's house around 10 a.m. on January 22nd to pick up the girls and take them to a birthday party. He explained that he and Kit had switched around their custody schedule at Kit's behest. He also noted that he usually picked the girls up on Fridays. A few hours later, around 1 p.m., Detective Cross and another detective drove to Poway, about an hour and a half south of Anaheim, to interview Greg Mordick in person at his parents' house. When asked whether there had ever been any violence in their marriage, Greg told police that there may have been one incident where he had shaken Kit. But according to police, at that time, Greg did not disclose to them the same details that they would later discover he had written in his journals. In his journals, Greg recounted arguments with Kit, at least one of which had resulted in them striking each other as their young daughters watched. But he did not share those memories with police when being questioned in connection with Kit's murder. Greg told the detectives that on the morning of January 22nd, when he arrived at Kit's house to pick up the girls, he went inside the house to get the girls and remembered the television and the stereo speaker set being in their usual place, not on the floor near the front door. He recalled going into the bedroom and opening a closet door to check on a silkscreen that he had left in there. When asked about any knives in the home, Greg told the detectives that a butcher block knife set was kept in a cabinet in the kitchen. According to Greg, he and the girls arrived at the birthday party in Huntington Beach, about 30 to 40 minutes away from Kit's house in Anaheim, around 11 a.m. or possibly earlier. The host of that birthday party, Jana Johnson, later told detectives that she recalled Greg and the girls arriving at the party between 11:30 and 11:45 a.m. It's not specified whether anyone else who attended the birthday party was questioned about Greg's arrival. A few days later, on February 1st, 1983, detectives asked Greg to come to the police department for another interview. Detectives once again asked Greg about the knives in the butcher block, and Greg told them that he wasn't sure if all of the knives were there, because the last time he'd spoken to Kit, she apologized for losing one of those knives. Detectives came up with a ruse to attempt to catch Greg in a lie. They told Greg that a witness had seen him re-enter Kit's house after putting the two girls into the car. Of course, this was not true. Greg told detectives that he had seen a quote-unquote gentleman there, presumably referring to one of the neighbors, but he adamantly denied going back into the house after buckling the girls into the car. Greg was insistent that he put the girls in the car, walked back up and closed the gate, then got in the car and left. According to Greg, he and Kit had a policy of quote-unquote not going back. This is a bit vague, but it seems that Greg meant that he generally did not re-enter the house once he left. Greg also told detectives that when he returned to the car after closing the gate, his daughter Elise, who was 4 years old at that time, asked him, quote-unquote, "What took you so long, Daddy?" and, quote-unquote, "Did you and Mommy have a fight?" Greg said that he responded by telling Elise, quote, "No, we don't do that anymore," end quote. He offered up this information to detectives completely unprompted. There has been quite a lot of speculation about why his young daughter would imply that he took a long time to return to the car, or why she would assume that he and Kit had a fight. I just want to make a point here as a mother to a five-year-old. Kids have a very distorted sense of time. My daughter will ask for a snack, and if she hasn't received said snack within 5 minutes of asking, she'll be complaining that it's taking ages to get her snack. Greg's daughter Elise could have been sitting in the car waiting for Greg to return for 30 seconds, and to her, it could have felt like 30 minutes. As for Elise asking if Greg and Kit had a fight, Greg wrote in his journals that the girls had witnessed several heated arguments, and even at least one physical altercation between him and Kit. Kids are so much more perceptive than we give them credit for. As a parent to a small child, it does not seem unusual to me that a curious, unfiltered four-year-old would ask if her parents had been fighting again, because she had observed it before. I don't know whether this statement from Greg was truthful or a lie. My point here is that the credibility of his statement cannot be fairly determined based on alleged comments and questions from a four-year-old. When police questioned Henry, Kit's boyfriend, about his whereabouts on the night that Kit was murdered, he told police that he had been in San Diego that entire weekend, about an hour and a half away from Anaheim. According to Henry, he arrived at his brother's house in San Diego between 5 and 6 p.m. on January 21st and left to return home between 9 and 9:30 a.m. on January 23rd, the day after Kit's suspected time of death. Henry was reportedly in San Diego that weekend to celebrate his nephew's birthday. Henry also told investigators that over the course of that weekend, he had tried to call Kit multiple times, but she never answered the phone. It's not clear how thoroughly investigators checked out Henry's alibi, or whether they checked it out at all. Months passed, and then a full year, and Kit's case went cold. By the summer of 1984, Kit's sister Donna had divorced her husband and had married someone new, Henry Bjoin, the man that Kit had an affair with during her marriage to Greg, the man who Kit was in a relationship with at the time that she was murdered. A year and a half after Kit's murder, and her boyfriend had married her sister. While it's a bit bizarre, there's not much else to share about that. As far as I can tell, Donna and Henry remained married until his death, which I believe was in 2022. After Kit's murder, Gregory Mordick moved to Spokane, Washington with his two daughters. He eventually opened up his own photography studio, called Photography by Gregory, where he specialized in family portraits and wedding photos. In 1999, 16 years after Kit's murder, her case was finally reopened. By that point, forensics and DNA testing had made tremendous advances, and the blood samples that were collected at the crime scene back in 1983 were finally tested and analyzed. The blood that was collected from the wall near the front door of the house was a match to Kit. Blood collected from a plastic bag found in a closet, as well as blood collected from a closet door, were consistent with Greg Mordick. Further testing on the plastic bag found that the frequency of people with DNA that would match that sample would be 1 in 1 trillion. Blood collected from a bathroom sink and blood collected from the rear sliding door both had a major and minor contributor. For both samples, the major contributor was consistent with Kit, and the minor contributor was consistent with Greg. The forensic scientist who tested these samples would later testify that the sample collected from the bathroom sink was most likely a mixture of blood from one contributor and saliva from the other contributor. There was another sample of blood collected from the drapery on the rear sliding door that was also found to have major and minor contributors. And again, the major contributor was consistent with Kit, and the minor contributor was consistent with Greg. However, these samples were collected and stored in evidence in 1983. When the case was reopened in 1999, it was discovered that while in storage, a vial of Greg Mordick's blood had cracked and spilled onto the envelope containing the blood sample collected from the drapery. It's possible that the spilled vial could have contaminated other pieces of evidence as well, but case documents only specify the envelope containing the sample from the drapery. I also think it's important to note that, according to case documents, 1. There were blood samples in the house that were not even collected as evidence. 2. There were blood samples that were collected as evidence but were never tested. And 3. There were blood samples that were collected and tested but that came back inconclusive. Also worth mentioning is the fact that Kit and Greg shared the house on South Ridgecrest Circle for several years before their separation. Greg had only moved out of the house 3 to 4 months before Kit's murder. What the DNA testing did not find, however, was any of Greg's DNA anywhere on Kit's body or the clothes that she was wearing at the time of her murder. In January 2001, investigators traveled to Spokane, Washington to speak with Greg Mordick again. It was at this time that they collected 6 of Greg's journals that were later submitted as evidence. Those journals contain the entries that I read earlier in the episode. In 2003, a grand jury convened regarding Kit Mordick's murder. However, the only records related to that grand jury are witness statements gathered before the grand jury convened. There are no available records or information regarding the actual grand jury proceedings or outcome. On February 6, 2008, investigators once again interviewed Greg Mordick, 25 years after Kit's murder. Investigators once again attempted a ruse to see how Greg would respond. They told Greg that his DNA was found on the waistband of the tights Kit had been wearing, the tights that were on the floor next to her body. Greg adamantly denied that his DNA could have been anywhere on her clothes. He did, however, ever so slightly change one aspect of the story that he had maintained for 25 years. An investigator asked Greg, quote, "I know, give us something here. Give us an opportunity to help figure this out. What really happened that day? What happened when you went back in that second time? Why did you go back in?" End quote. Greg responded, quote, "I told everybody I'd forgotten the birthday card in the present we were going to take to Jan and Phil's," end quote. Greg then said, quote, "I took the kids out to the car and forgot the birthday present," end quote. The investigator asked him, quote, "And what happened? What happened when you got back in the house?" end quote. Greg said, quote unquote, "I'm sorry," as though he hadn't heard what the investigator said. The investigator said again, quote, "What happened when you got back in the house? Because that's where the crux of this whole thing," end quote. Greg partially cut him off and said, quote, "Nothing. I picked up the present and left," end quote. So after more than 2 decades of insisting that he never went back into the house after taking the girls out to the car, Greg suddenly recalled that he had actually forgotten the birthday present in the house. So he put the girls in their car seats and went back inside the house to get the birthday present. On February 6, 2008, Gregory Mordick was arrested and prosecutors filed a felony complaint charging him with the murder of Catherine "Kit" Mordick 25 years later. He was arraigned on February 22, 2008. In late 2009, the case went to trial. Deputy Coroner Lucky, who had arrived at the crime scene around 2:55 a.m. on January 24, 1983, was called to the stand to testify. When he arrived at the crime scene, he had made the preliminary estimate that Kit had died in the p.m. hours of January 22nd. Now, at trial, Lucky testified that it was possible that Kit could have died as early as 10 a.m. on January 22nd. Dr. Richard Fukumoto, who performed the autopsy on Kit back in 1983, was also called to the stand. During the autopsy, Dr. Fukumoto had determined that Kit had likely died between 36 and 48 hours prior to the autopsy, which would put her estimated time of death between 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. on January 22, 1983. And at trial, Dr. Fukumoto maintained that belief. One witness called to testify was Jana Johnson, the woman who hosted the birthday party that Greg took his 2 daughters to that Saturday morning. When the defense asked if she had noticed any injuries to Mr. Mordick, Johnson responded no, and when the defense asked if she, quote-unquote, noticed any blood on him in any manner, Johnson said, quote-unquote, "Oh my goodness, no." The defense also asked Jana Johnson about Kit's relationship with Henry. They asked, quote, "Did she tell you that things weren't working out with someone named Henry?" end quote. Johnson replied, quote, "I believe that she indicated there were some problems with him, yes," end quote. The defense was setting up their implication that it was actually Henry Bjoyn who had murdered Kit. The defense pointed out that when Henry had gone through the rear sliding door and discovered Kit's body, he had left the door just slightly ajar, just as the killer had done, according to Henry himself. Henry was called to the stand to testify. The defense asked him, quote, "Do you only partially close doors when you go through them?" end quote. To which Henry responded, quote, "I don't remember closing the door, so if that's how far I closed it, that's how far I closed it," end quote. The prosecution reiterated the fact that Henry was nearly 2 hours away in San Diego for that entire weekend. But again, I cannot find any information about how thoroughly Henry's alibi was checked out. Gregory Mordick himself took the stand in his own defense. The defense asked, quote, "After you put Bree in and went and closed the gate, did you ever go back into the house?" end quote. To which Greg responded, no. Another contradictory statement. And when the defense asked, quote, "What did you think when they told you about your DNA being found on her clothes?" end quote. Greg said, quote, "I was going, there's no way. I didn't touch Kitty that morning," end quote. Reminder that Greg's DNA was not found on any of Kit's clothes. That was just a ruse conjured up by the police as an interrogation tactic. In regards to his journals, the prosecution asked Greg, quote, "You wrote at various times that it was almost more than you could bear thinking about that separation," end quote. Greg answered, quote, "I'm sorry I wrote that down. It's come to bite me now instead of being true feelings at the time. You're trying to make it bite me," end quote. On the Dateline episode that covered the case, Keith Morrison later asked Greg why he kept those journals for so many years. Greg said, quote, "There's nothing in there except my history, our history together. What was to be thrown away?" end quote. Keith then pointed out that Greg had admitted in those journals that there was violence between him and Kit, to which Greg responded, cutting Keith off, quote, "Yes, yes, and Kitty started every one of them, unfortunately. I got tired of being hit, so I grabbed her arms, and I'm the bad guy," end quote. There are no other accounts that I could find that confirm that Kit was violent in their relationship. The only mention of Kit being violent is in Greg's journals. Back to the trial in 2009. The jury retired and ended up deliberating for several days. They were deadlocked, 6-6. It ended in a mistrial. But the case went to trial again in September 2010. This time, the defense came armed with new DNA results. They had retested the blood sample collected from the rear sliding door at the crime scene. That sample was determined to be a mixture of Kit's blood and Greg's DNA. Through this testing, they discovered that Greg and both of his daughters shared an identical blood protein. The defense argued that this could mean that that blood sample collected from the rear sliding door was not necessarily a mixture of Kit's blood and Greg's DNA specifically, but that it could be a mixture of Kit's blood and DNA from the rest of the family, and could have accumulated over several years. The jury deliberated for 2 days. In November 2010, Gregory Mordick was found guilty of the first-degree murder of his wife, Catherine Kit O'Connell Mordick, on January 22, 1983. The new DNA results had not been enough to sway the jury. In January 2011, at Greg's sentencing hearing, Kit's family read their statements to Greg. Kit's brother Joe, who had discovered her body alongside Henry Bjoyn all those years ago, said, quote, "There's a hole in our lives, a hole left by this murder," end quote. And Kit's sister Donna, who married Henry Bjoyn in 1984, said, quote, "I wish her children had an idea of what they've missed out on in their life," end quote. Greg shared a statement of his own, saying, quote, "The O'Connell family thinks they're the only ones who's missed Kitty, and that's not true. She is missed by my family, myself, and my two beautiful daughters," end quote. Elise, Kit and Greg's eldest daughter, also spoke at the sentencing hearing. She said, quote, "My family now, and I, have now been sentenced to another 25 years of pain and agony. I miss my mother very much, but it's not fair that my father is being taken away," end quote. Gregory Mordick was sentenced to 25 years to life. All sources for this episode can be found in the show notes. You can find Crime and Crime Again on X at Crime Again Pod, on Instagram at Crime Again Podcast, and on TikTok at Crime Again Podcast. Be sure to check out the YouTube channel, which will also be linked in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode of Crime and Crime Again.